Hey, Levitt, pretend for a minute that you've decided to open up a restaurant. Can you imagine that?
Sure. Easy to imagine something like that.
Mm-hmm. Would you enjoy it?
No, I would hate it more than anything.
Oh. But you can imagine. You can at least imagine.
I can imagine.
What kind of food would you serve?
Probably fast food, because it's my favorite kind of food. Uh-huh. I think that's what I would probably open.
Could you imagine opening, like, something with an Asian cuisine?
Yeah, there's a really great Asian restaurant in the basement of LaGuardia Airport. I could open one of those. Do you know what I'm talking about? You've eaten there with me. I've made you eat there.
Oh, yeah. That's kind of fast food. Yeah, sure.
Yeah, exactly. Fast food Asian.
The sweet and sour chicken. Yeah. Right.
Bourbon chicken.
That's what it is. The bourbon chicken. Okay. So you would open an airport fast food Chinese restaurant would be your heart's desire. And let me ask you this. How do you think you would approach hiring the wait staff of this Chinese fast food airport restaurant? Do you want them to match the food in some way?
Absolutely.
Why is that?
When it comes to ethnic food, I'm not sure why, but we've decided that it tastes better when it's served by people of that ethnicity.
I'm guessing you may have noticed this too. We certainly have in my family. My son Solomon noticed it a few years ago when he was like 10. What is going on here? That was a question put to us by one of our listeners.
Hey, Freakonomics Radio. This is Bailey Hicken out of Salt Lake City, Utah. And I have a question for you guys. I was at dinner last night having sushi, and I had this realization that every worker at every sushi restaurant that I've ever been to is Asian, or at least Asian-ish looking. So is it a prerequisite that you have to be Asian looking to work at a sushi restaurant? And if it is, can they do that?
Bailey explained a bit further in an email. She wrote, if someone wanted to hire all white or American looking people at, let's say, some very Americanized restaurant, then people would be pissed. Or all black, all women, all gay, whatever, really. How do the Asians get away with it, she wrote. Let it be noted that my grandpa is Japanese, so I am a quarter, and I love the Asians.
So maybe you guys could look into it for me. Who knows? A girl can dream, right?
Yes, Bailey, a girl can dream. And we will dream right along with you. We will try to figure out where this restaurant racial profiling comes from. If it makes sense, if it's legal. And of course, we should know it's not only Asian restaurants we're talking about here. We're talking about restaurants that make Indian food, served by people from Pakistan and Bangladesh, Italian food, served by Croatian or Serbian waitstaff, and Mexican food, too. Speaking of which, hey, what's your favorite Mexican dish?
I love the chimichanga.
From WNYC Studios, this is Freakonomics Radio, the show that explores the hidden side of everything. Here's your host, Stephen Dubner.
Neither Steve Levitt nor I have ever run a restaurant. So, to try to figure out the ethnic hiring patterns at restaurants, I thought we'd start with some people who actually do run a restaurant, or two. Okay, we're in the kitchen. I'm seeing some charred red peppers.
This is the enchilada station and the quesadilla station.
That's Nat Milner, and this is his wife, Liz O. Milner.
This kitchen smells amazing.
Liz and Nat own and operate two restaurants in Manhattan on the Upper West Side, pretty close to where I live, as it turns out. And as it turns out, my family and I really like both their restaurants. One is called Elizabeth's Neighborhood Table, named after Liz. It calls its cuisine thoughtful American comfort food. And right next door is Gabriella's Restaurant and Tequila Bar. That's where we are now. You want to walk us through here to the kitchen quickly?
Sure.
Gabriella's, as you've probably figured out by now, is a Mexican restaurant.
This is Rita. Rita's in charge of everything. She makes
Hola.
Sauces, tamales.
Bien.
This is the homemade corn tortillas being made right here. It's a real old school metal press. You just put a ball of dough in there, flatten it out, and throw it on the hot griddle.
Nat Milner comes from a real New York restaurant family. His uncle, Arthur Cutler, was a pioneer, a Jewish guy on Long Island, who figured out that what New York really needed was a big, noisy, family-style Italian place called Carmine's and a Chinatown-style noodle shop with roast meats called Ollie's and Virgil's, a Southern-style barbecue joint in Times Square, back when Times Square was really Times Square. Arthur Cutler liked to zig when everybody else was zagging, as I learned from his nephew, Nat. So, okay, so let's go back to the beginning of Gabriella's. First of all, who is Gabriella, the person?
Well, Gabriella worked for my uncle, and she would have been helping out with my cousin and cooking meals once in a while. And my uncle would come home and say, well, holy cow, this food is great. What is this? It was like the late 80s, early 90s, and everything was Tex-Mex. And Gabriella said, I don't know, this is just what I cook at home.
She's Mexican, Gabriella?
Yeah. Gabriella Hernandez.
So it was kind of home-style, fresh Mexican. What part of Mexico is she from?
Guadalajara.
Okay. And so your uncle says, hey, we should open a restaurant featuring your food? That's the way it worked?
Basically. She brought up, her whole family came into the business, and uncle was the original chef. He came up with all the, Hector came up with all the recipes and designed the whole menu and put it all together.
So when we call Gabriella's a Mexican restaurant, it really is pretty Mexican. The moles, the ceviches, the chimichangas. Arthur Cutler, Nat's uncle, the restaurant pioneer, he died young in 1997. Nat was living in Alaska, where he'd gone to hang out, fish salmon, and that's where he met Liz. She's from Boston. She went to Alaska as a Jesuit volunteer. By now, they'd fallen in love, married, had a kid, and when Nat's uncle died and Nat heard the family could use some help in their restaurants back in New York, Nat and Liz moved back. And Nat wound up running Gabriella's. The food today is pretty much the same as it was at the beginning. The recipes are authentic Mexican. The vibe is Mexican-ish. The tequila is most definitely Mexican. What about the people who work there? So in a given, let's say, busy shift, I don't know, a Thursday night, Friday night, Saturday night, obviously get really busy. How many front of room workers do you have here?
We'll have, on a real busy night in the summer, we'll have about 10 servers on.
10 servers, okay. Is that waitresses, waiters, or is that
waiters
different?
And waiters.
Okay, and then...
Then bussers and runners and bartenders and barbacks and all the kitchen staff.
Okay, all in front of the room, front of the house, on a Friday night, let's say, would be then 20, 25 people?
Yeah, that sounds about right.
Okay, how many of them are Mexican?
Well, I don't really have the breakdown.
You don't have the papers in front of you.
Yeah, but, I would say probably 40%.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah, okay. But everyone's pretty much Latin. Everyone speaks Spanish. A lot of people are from Colombia, Ecuador, Dominican Republic.
Does it matter that a server might be Dominican serving Mexican food in your view?
I don't think that matters.
Yeah, right. But how many non-Latinos do you have front of the house?
Very few.
Why so few non-Latinos in a Mexican restaurant? Does this come from the supply side, the restaurant, or the demand side, the customers? As Nat talked me through it, he pointed out that he doesn't actually do the hiring, the general manager does, and he is from Mexico.
You have a corporate culture, right? And you have a group of people, and you're trying to grow a team. And, you put out ads. A lot of ads go in Spanish newspapers, or especially for the back of the house. The front of the house, we tend to always have a good selection of people who want to work, and we don't really advertise
their
jobs.
They kind of come to you through other people who are working here. Gotcha.
And we have sisters and brothers and cousins and extended families working throughout the.
I assume they're mostly then speaking Spanish to each other on the job.
Mostly, yeah.
Gotcha.
Especially in the back.
Especially in the back, right. So the back is all Latino as well?
Mm-hmm.
Gotcha. Okay, so what if I, however, I'm 25 years old, I just moved to New York from Pennsylvania, and I happen to be white, and I'm looking for a waiter job or waitress job, and I come to you guys,
We would hire you, for sure.
You would?
Yeah, you want a job?
I do not, actually. At this moment, I do not. Although I could be your tequila taster. I think I'd be good at that.
We honestly don't get a lot of people like that walking in.
Yeah, so that's what I want to know, is how it works. So is it a kind of self-selection in terms of the hiring and the applying?
In that sense, yeah. I mean, back in the day, you could be 16, 17, 18 years old looking for a job as a busboy.
Right.
now those jobs just aren't there because you have adults who want those jobs.
Like even paper boys are now adults.
Yeah, I mean, you have people who, you know, why would I have a 17-year-old working here when I can have a 28-year-old man with a who has a baby and is trying to support his family?
Now, let me ask you this. For the people who come here to eat, do you think they care that the front of the house is all Latino in terms of making it kind of the right experience, whether that's about authenticity or whatnot?
I think there's a little aspect of that, but I don't give it much credence. I mean, it might be a little bit. I know that when you walk into Gabriella's, you don't want to see me. I mean,
why? I mean, I don't mind seeing you.
I know, but you're looking to see Gabriella, yeah, right? You know, I have red curly hair and a red beard, and I mean, I think there's something to say about that. I mean, that people want to come to a Mexican restaurant and be surrounded by Spanish-speaking people with dark hair.
Right, yeah.
For one, I feel like the pace, the way things move here, I know we've had some people come in who are not Latino, but they'll be here, but they don't stay long. I think it's just one of those things where it's moving fast. You're in the kitchen. You're speaking Spanish.
It's because of
language
barrier.
You understand the food. You're excited about the food.
If you come to work here and you don't speak Spanish and you don't fit in with the culture of the family meal and eating with people and laughing with people, you kind of feel like you're a little bit outside of it. I even feel that when I'm walking around, but I just muscle through.
But what about restaurants that serve Asian cuisine? Why would a Japanese-style sushi restaurant hire wait staff who are Korean, Vietnamese, Filipino?
Well, I think it goes back to the same thing about who walks in the door looking for these jobs.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if I'm Asian, I'm not going to go to a Mexican restaurant and say, you know, can I get a job here? I mean, you might, and, you know, we hire all kinds of people, but, you know, you might rather go to an Asian restaurant and feel a little more...
Yeah.
You know, I don't have a good answer for that. But I think a lot of the people who are coming here are the first generation. You know, they're just here. They're trying to work their butts off. They're trying to make something. And, you know, there's some truth to that.
Oh, so that's interesting. So the work ethic of the immigrant or maybe the first generation American coincides well with the needs of a restaurant that happens to be an ethnic restaurant, right? I mean, it's so that might be one reason why the hiring kind of self-selects itself like that.
Yeah, I would think it's got something to do with it. You know, I will also say, like, you know, you're talking about the 25-year-old kid who's coming to New York City and he's trying to make something and he's trying to get a job. He's not coming to New York to be a waiter. He can do that in Omaha, right?
Right.
So he's coming here to do something else, whatever that might be. It's like that TV show Taxi, right? No, none of them are really taxi drivers except for Alex, right? Everyone was an actor, one was a boxer, one was a comedian, whatever.
Right.
It's the same kind of thing. So if he's sitting here and I have someone who's more of a... you know, sees the restaurant industry as a career.
Right.
You know, I would certainly think of them over someone who's, you know, maybe going to be here 3 months and then get a show on Broadway and disappear or whatever.
Right. Yeah. And that is a problem that Nat and Liz have had at their other restaurant, Elizabeth's Neighborhood Table. From the street, the two restaurants are just next door, but from the back, through the kitchen at Gabriella's, you see they're actually attached.
And we have a secret back door over here.
And just like that, you go from a kitchen producing guacamole and ceviche to a kitchen with pancakes and eggs on the griddle. Elizabeth's does a big brunch business with the classics. They have a great corned beef, by the way. Lunch and dinner bring creative salads and comfort foods like turkey meatloaf and grass-fed burgers.
We have wonderful soups. I'm not even sure what soups we have today.
Oh, that's my corned beef. Now, I'm excited to see a can of Pam in your kitchen, because I need Pam once in a while. Do you use it regularly?
I do. I mean, on our...
on the waffle iron.
On the waffle iron, yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay. And the kitchen here...
I don't know if I'm excited that you saw our Pam.
Well, I know. The kitchen staff at Elizabeth's, like at Gabriella's, is all Latino. Orders are called out in Spanish.
Mauro, dame unos pancakes con blueberries, por favor.
But step through the kitchen door into the dining room, and you get a very different vibe. Gabriella's has Day of the Dead figurines and Mexican decor with empty tequila barrels out front. Elizabeth's looks like a New England beach house. Wainscoting, Martha Stewart-y color palette, brass wall sconces. The wait staff is much more of a mix than Gabriella's. Most definitely not all Latina. So I have to say, this transports me to a place. I don't mean to sound racist because it's against me, mm-hmm. but this transports me to a place where there's a lot of white people. Which, and look, most, some of my best friends are white people. So was there a, did you feel at some point any kind of, not pressure, but desire to make the wait staff look more like East Hampton-y or Connecticut-y or...
We really want to reflect the neighborhood here. Yeah. I mean, that's really what we wanted to do.
I mean, there's plenty of white people in the neighborhood. I live in the neighborhood. Yeah. You live in the neighborhood.
Yeah, we have plenty of white servers, too.
The chef at Elizabeth's Neighborhood Table is Tomas Areñas. He's from Mexico. Over the past decade plus, he's worked at a lot of restaurants in New York, and he says he's noticed a big shift in the demographics.
Everywhere you go now, it's you got to find Mexicans, all Latinos. It's not like before. I remember before, it was like, if you go like Italian cuisine, you find all Italian people. Now it's not.
But there's usually a split, he says, between the kitchen and the front of the house.
If you see a lot of different restaurants, if you see in front of the house, it's like more like, it's white people in the front. Some Latinos, but not a lot. I think in the back of the house is like most of the time is Latinos.
If you look at restaurant and food industry jobs in the U.S. by ethnicity, as compiled by the Bureau of Labor Statistics, you'll see that 25% of those jobs are held by Latinos, while Latinos make up only 17% of the U.S. population. So, for whatever reason or set of reasons, restaurant work has become a Latino stronghold, especially in the kitchen. But here's my question. Is the practice of hiring Latino servers at a Mexican restaurant or white servers at an American-style restaurant, or for that matter, Asian servers at a Japanese or Thai restaurant, is this discrimination?
I personally wouldn't call that discrimination, or at least not the kind of discrimination to get upset about.
That, again, is Steve Levitt, my Freakonomics friend and co-author, who could see himself opening a Chinese fast food restaurant at an airport.
The kind of discrimination we usually worry about is discrimination where employers make choices about who to hire based on criteria that are unrelated to performance on the job. So, for instance, if it's answering a phone and it's men versus women, when there's no evidence that men are better at answering phones than women. So I would say in a Chinese restaurant, looking Asian is an important part of fulfilling the task. Those people don't cost any more to hire than the Mexican staff at a Mexican restaurant or the Indian staff at an Indian restaurant, but they enhance the experience of the people who are dining there.
Because you think that the customer has a happier experience if he or she thinks that the wait staff is related to the country where the food is from. That's the reason why it's better or more optimal? Because honestly, as you're describing what does constitute discrimination, I was thinking that this is it, not the opposite of it.
No, I think if that Chinese restaurant had not a single Asian person ever in sight, I bet that you and I would talk about that a lot when we were in the restaurant. Mm. And that would be evidence to me that it matters to the customers whether they, the service staff are Asian or not.
Yeah, but that may be just, I'm just curious whether maybe this is just a custom and because it's been around for a long time, we accept it as either, you know, sensible or optimal or fair, but maybe in fact, it's none of those. Like, what if I say, you know what? Most podcast hosts are men, or most of the hosts of the biggest podcasts in the world are men. Therefore, that's evidence that men are plainly better. And therefore, I do not want any women touching my podcast. Isn't that pretty similar to arguing that I do not want any non-Asian people serving me Asian food?
I think that's a little different because your question really intersects with how we think about markets. And in general, economists tend to think that when there are a lot of different options for workers to go out and find jobs in different places, the impact of the kind of discrimination or at least differentiation that you're describing at this Chinese restaurant just turns out not to be very important. Now, if there were no jobs, if the only jobs in the economy were Chinese restaurants, then we would really worry a lot about who gets hired and doesn't at restaurants. But in a world where there are Japanese restaurants and Mexican restaurants and Indian restaurants and fast food restaurants, I just can't get too excited about worrying about what I would call discrimination in terms of hiring, when I think you can make a good case, rightly or wrongly, that customers care who serves them. But if you think about it realistically, why should it matter what the ethnicity is of the server in a Chinese restaurant? You might very well worry about the cook, but you don't see the cook. But somehow the server, you're right, is probably just decoration, right? It's not important to the quality of the food.
All right, so Levitt, let's pretend that the restaurant that you decide to open, or maybe we'll open it together. You and I are going to open a restaurant together, let's say in New York, and let's say it's Swedish, okay? And we call it Smorgasbord, okay? Does this mean that you want to hire only really Swedish-looking people?
Absolutely.
You want to hire a bunch of tall, blonde people with blue eyes who are probably good skiers, and yeah, that's what you want?
For sure. If I have a Swedish restaurant, I want to fill it up not just with people who are tall and blonde, but who have nice Swedish accents as well, whether they're real or fake.
And so how do you advertise for those jobs in the paper? That was the longest pause I've ever heard out of Steve Levitt. I've heard some long pauses out of Steve Levitt.
Well, one thing I might do is advertise in Stockholm to really find some people who will come from Sweden and work at your restaurant. But I think I would start by saying the name of the restaurant and that we serve Swedish cuisine. Maybe I would advertise in Swedish if I really thought that I wanted to be super serious about that. Maybe I just advertise at modeling agencies, which will have lots of tall, blonde-haired, blue-eyed women.
All right. But let's be honest. It's trickier to advertise. You know, I'm not going to say whites only or blondes only for a Swedish restaurant. Whereas if I open an Indian restaurant, I know that my customers in New York, the vast majority of them may not know or care the difference between an Indian waiter, a Pakistani waiter, a Bangladeshi waiter, et cetera, right? So I can lump them together comfortably. I can't lump together like blonde whites, though, comfortably, can I? And if not, is that fair?
I think you can lump them. Can you tell the difference between a Swede and a German and a Finn? I can't.
At first blush, I'd say absolutely not, right? But when I say lump together, I mean put out my net to attract them.
Yeah, so that is a different question. I wonder what would happen if you put a want ad in the paper that said, looking for Swedish-looking people to serve in my restaurant. And I don't know anything about the legal background on it, but I would be fascinated to find out what the legal standing is of those kind of choices, because my hunch is that you might be able to get away with that. Are you going to have some experts on? You should have a legal expert on, for sure.
Okay, Levitt, after the break, we will have a legal expert on to talk about ethnic-based restaurant hiring.
The statute is pretty clear. And if you're taking ethnicity into account, you are technically subject to an employment discrimination lawsuit.
We'll also hear from someone at the federal agency that enforces discrimination law in the workplace.
We don't condone hiring solely on the basis of ethnicity. That is illegal. You cannot decide we're a Chinese restaurant, we only want Chinese, or we're a Mexican restaurant, we only want Latinos.
And because the world is interesting, we'll also talk to a white Irish-American comedian who got a job as a greeter at a Chinese restaurant in China and did not like how he was greeted.
Hey, listen, buddy, if I was in New York and I walked into a restaurant and the welcomer was like, oh, you're very welcome. And I went, oh, you're very welcome. Oh, welcome to our restaurant. You want a fine wine? Well, I'd be arrested.
If you want to hear more Freakonomics Radio, check out our website at Freakonomics.com, where you can find the podcast, our books, a blog, and much more.
From WNYC Studios, this is Freakonomics Radio. Here's your host, Stephen Dubner.
Des Bishop is a comedian, very popular in some parts of the world.
So would you please welcome Mr. Des Bishop.
America! That's him appearing on a late-night talk show in Ireland.
Oh, yeah.
Thank you.
You're so welcome, as always.
This is cool, man.
I actually know you.
Bishop grew up in New York and moved to Ireland as a teenager. He has hosted shows on Irish TV that are part comedy, part reality series. One of them was about sending an American-Irish comic to China to see how he made out.
Des Bishop is in China.
So for 2 years, Bishop lived in China. He studied Mandarin, he lived with a Chinese family and immersed himself in the culture, and he performed a stand-up act in Mandarin. Okay, so can you give us, like, maybe the beginning or a favorite part of your Mandarin routine in Mandarin right now, and I'll see how it works on me?
Okay, this is a quick one. So, 我跟我的女朋友吵架, 她说我很委屈, you're just laughing at my Chinese, that's different.
As part of the TV show that Des Bishop was making in China for Irish TV, he took a job as a greeter in a Chinese restaurant, not a host. Just a greeter.
A host actually sits people. I literally just had to greet people.
That's all you did? Why would they hire someone to do that? Especially
that's a job.
I mean,
that's like a real job in China. A yinbing yuan is literally a welcomer. That's their job.
Okay. So you would literally say hello to people as they came in and say goodbye when they left and
yes.
Thank you?
Yeah, and you have to say it very loudly and kind of, it's a Chinese thing. When you're in China, you notice like you walk in and they're like, Huan ying, guan ling, really loudly. And that, I guess that people feel it gives them face or whatever.
The job was in Hugang, a city of about 1 million people, relatively small as Chinese cities go. Bishop lived with the other employees in staff housing. The restaurant fed him and paid him about $300 a month. And just tell me a little bit, just because I have no idea, I'm curious to know, is going out to eat in a restaurant like this, in a city like this, is it kind of a special deal, or is it more like a once-a-week thing that families will do? Is it more for celebration? Is it more, adults or families or even teenagers? Just tell me a little bit about that.
Mostly adults and families. I mean, the speciality of this restaurant is it's all rooms. There's no actual... Mm-hmm. There was no actual like canteen part. It was all like private rooms. But eating out has become affordable in China. I mean, food prices are low and, you know, the economy is booming and people can go out to eat. So it was largely always busy. And it's just a, middle level, just busy restaurant with people just going out and having a nice time.
What's the name of the restaurant?
I actually can't even remember. That's what's so embarrassing. To be honest, my Chinese was so bad at the time, I don't even think I ever really registered the name of the restaurant.
You never learned the name.
But I just knew how to get there. I knew how to point in the taxi.
All right. You're a white guy, and I'm guessing in a city this size, there aren't a lot of white guys around?
No, I'm the only white guy that's ever done this job, probably in the history of China, let alone the history of this small town. So every day customers would arrive and I wouldn't really become a welcomer. I would become the guy that has the same conversation every day, all day. I would just like talk to customers and they'd be like, why are you here?
I see. All right. So pretend I walk in, greet me.
欢迎光临.
And then I would say...
You might say, 我姓李, like my name is Li. And then I might just look at the book and say, Fa La Li. All the rooms were named after expensive cars. So I would say, oh, Nimen Zai Fa La Li, which is Ferrari. And so then I would, but to be honest, that so rarely happened because my Chinese was bad. So like he would say, Wo Xing Li. And like, it's easy for me to say it now. I can even see the character, but back then I couldn't. You know?
Gotcha.
So really, what I would say, 欢迎光临. Sometimes I would get confident. I would say, 那个房间先生, like, what room, sir? And they wouldn't even acknowledge me. They would just turn to a Chinese person, assuming that there is no way in the world I could have got them to the right room.
And that, Des Bishop says, was the common response from restaurant customers in Hugang, China, seeing this American-Irish host in their Chinese restaurant.
This is the number one sound I would hear every day. Hey? It's just like that. What? Literally, because that's a sound Chinese people make. And then so 50% of the time they would talk to me, 50% they would just ignore me. You know, Chinese people, it's funny because we're very politically correct here nowadays and we're kind of obsessed with it. And people here often think that the main issue that you would encounter is like how to work around the sensitivities of race in China. But there are no sensitivities around race. They're all Chinese, right?
A few weeks into his greeter job, Bishop was starting to feel pretty comfortable. And then one night, he says, these three drunk guys came into the restaurant.
Now, this town is in Dongbei. It's in the northeast of China, which has a reputation for the people being a bit rough around the edges, a bit gregarious, right? So these three guys come in smoking with their man bags. They all have man bags. And I did my best. 欢迎光临. And then one of them really loudly in front of all the staff, like in front of all the girls, because by the way, it's also a girl's job that I'm doing. I'm like the only guy that's ever done it. That's why I'm so high pitched when I say Huanying Guanling, because I learned it off of these women that were surrounding me. And so I said, Huan Ying Guan Ling. And then one of them really loudly, like in front of everybody, goes, Huan Ying Guan Ling, and does like an impersonation of my bad Chinese, you know, with like a really sort of like, you know, like a voice of making fun of me. And I remember thinking like, you cannot Huan Ying Guan Ling me. This is not acceptable. I'm the only white guy in this town that is definitely racist. Now, I know that people say there's no such thing as reverse racism, but I definitely felt for the first time in my life just like more of an other than I'd ever felt before.
Did it bother you, or did you?
Well, of course,
did you
it
just
bothered
say that's
me
the
because
way?
It bothered me because I thought, hey, listen, buddy, if I was in New York and I walked into a restaurant and the welcome was like, oh, you're very welcome, and I went, oh, you're very welcome, oh, welcome to our restaurant. You want a fried rice? Well, I'd be arrested. But it was immediate. It's sometimes you just have a moment of immediacy when it comes to material. I immediately said, thank you, a-hole, because that is definitely a routine. I cannot wait to tell that story in comedy clubs in the West, because I just knew that it was like absolutely true, but an absolutely winning moment.
So if the American-Irish Des Bishop was not authentic enough as a Mandarin-speaking greeter in China, where all the customers were Chinese, would he be any more authentic as an English-speaking host at maybe a Chinese restaurant in New York or California or Salt Lake City? Or, to ask the question we really want to answer, is the practice of hiring restaurant workers who match the cuisine fair?
Yeah, there are a couple of different ways to answer that question.
That's the legal expert we promised you. John Donahue teaches at Stanford Law School. He's an economist as well as a lawyer, and he's an expert on employment discrimination.
One is if fairness is defined by the employment discrimination laws, it probably isn't fair or legal to do this. And there are some caveats there, but as a general matter, hiring decisions are not supposed to be made on the basis of ethnicity with some caveats.
Donahue says this goes back to a certain piece of landmark American legislation.
The 1964 Civil Rights Act, which was the federal law that prohibited discrimination on the basis of race, sex, gender, and so on and so forth, was one of the most important laws passed at the federal level in this country in the last century.
Title VII of that law protects against employment discrimination. But one caveat, Donahue tells us, is firm size. At the federal level, only firms with 15 or more employees are subject to this law, although in some states the number is less. Another potential caveat, Donahue says, is the job itself.
There could be a situation where the discrimination is permitted if it's a bona fide occupational qualification.
A bona fide
BFOQ.
Okay.
That is a narrowly tailored term of art. And the idea behind the BFOQ defense is that you needed to hire in this otherwise discriminatory way because it's sort of an essential trait of the job.
I see. That would explain Hooters, I guess, yes? That's why neither you nor I could get a job at Hooters.
Exactly. So Hooters wins out on that rationale.
But the BFOQ defense is a tricky one. Hooters might argue that its customers don't want to see me or John Donahue in those bright orange short shorts and white tank tops. But how do they know? Maybe I could broaden their clientele and maximize their profits. Consider another industry that used to argue that being a certain kind of female was an essential part of the job.
It goes back to the early days of the 1964 civil rights laws application, where, for example, a number of the airlines initially tried to defend their practice of hiring attractive young women to be stewardesses on these airlines. And the reason they did that at the time in the 60s, it was largely a male business clientele that they were trying to appeal to. And they thought that they would find the fact of being served by a young and often required to be unmarried woman would be appealing to the customers.
This began to change in the late 1960s with a lawsuit filed by the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, or EEOC. That's the agency that enforces Title VII. and a man named Celio Diaz Jr. He wanted to be a flight attendant, and he sued Pan American Airlines for discrimination.
And they defended. They said, look, we're not doing anything discriminatory. We're just satisfying our customers' demands. And they brought in surveys that showed overwhelmingly their customers did want to be served by young, unmarried, and presumably attractive women. But the courts ruled that part of what the employment discrimination laws try to do is overcome discriminatory preferences and perhaps change those discriminatory preferences by opening up the job to everyone in a non-discriminatory fashion.
But I wonder, you know, look, we just lived through a period where unemployment could be really crushing for a lot of people. And there were a lot of people who were willing to take a lot of jobs that they might not have been willing to take 5 years earlier, 10 years earlier in a different economy. And I could imagine that there would be some people out there based on nothing more than what their face looks like that said, you know, I would have loved to have a job waiting tables in a sushi restaurant or in a Mexican restaurant or in an Italian restaurant. But because I don't look Asian and I don't look Latino and I don't look Italian, then those were off limits to me. So could you imagine a time in the perhaps not too distant future where this kind of hiring practice is looked at as unacceptable and perhaps even illegal?
It certainly could happen. And the statute is pretty clear. And if you're taking ethnicity into account without some of these other possible defenses being present, you are technically subject to an employment discrimination lawsuit.
I was wondering if we might care more if these were better paying jobs, right? I mean, if we were talking about software engineering or lawyering, for instance, where the stakes are financially higher, do you think we might have a different outlook on this kind of what seems to be just a, you know, kind of casual go along, get along, racial profiling hiring practice in restaurants?
Yeah, absolutely. The EEOC would care more, but even more to the point, Title VII gives a private right of action to anyone who's excluded, and they're able to bring lawsuits and win attorney's fees. So it's very easy to get a lawyer to take a case where there's going to be a lot of money at stake. But, you know, interestingly, we haven't seen much in the way of litigation in these small, you know, ethnic cuisine scenarios. Now, part of that could be, as we talked about, you know, the number of employees. You can also imagine in a slightly different twist from the way we've been describing it that, you know, let's say a Japanese restaurant owner hires relatives, then you could say, well, we're not discriminating on the basis of ethnicity. We're discriminating on the basis of, you know, familial relationship. And that might be a way around. But that doesn't get to the core question that we've been discussing, where you're not just hiring within your ethnicity, but in a sense, doing a little bit of a bait and switch by hiring other ethnicities.
I asked Steve Levitt the same question, whether the kind of hiring that restaurants do might pass under the radar because these are relatively low-paying jobs. What if, for instance, I'm starting an e-commerce site meant to appeal to Chinese customers and I decide I only want to hire Chinese programmers?
It's a tough question because I believe a lot in the power of firm culture and in the view that intangible things can dramatically affect productivity at companies. But you got to be super careful when you go down that path that the end result isn't to support some sort of massive subtext of discrimination, saying, well, we can't hire black people at this company because black people don't have the right culture for our company. I mean, that's the trade-off. But on the other hand, well, I don't know, you know, if you start out by hiring a bunch of you know, rich white people, maybe you end up wanting to hire a bunch more rich white people, and that can be a problem. It's tricky, really hard issues. Really, the issue of discrimination is one of the trickiest ones when it comes to the courts and when it comes to markets and thinking about it, because how even the right definition of what it means to be discriminatory is subtle, and it depends on the context.
How about the context of a retail clothing store? Maybe you caught this story recently about a discrimination case the EEOC won.
Bit of breaking news now from the U.S. Supreme Court. Earlier today, they ruled in favor of a Muslim woman who filed a lawsuit after she was denied a job at an Abercrombie and Fitch clothing store because she wore a headscarf for religious reasons. 8-1 vote this was.
That lawsuit that just came down started when a 17-year-old teenager walked into one of our offices or called one of our offices, and we took her case all the way through the lower court, the appeals court, and then to the Supreme Court.
That is Justine Lisser. She's a lawyer who works as a spokesperson for the EEOC. And she says the agency has brought several suits against restaurants that hire along ethnic lines, as we've been talking about today.
We sued a Houston restaurant, which was supposed to be an upscale Mexican restaurant, that fired already hired servers, one of whom was African-American, one of whom was Vietnamese, because they, quote, didn't speak Spanish. But it had an extremely diverse group of patrons. It certainly didn't have only a Spanish-speaking group of patrons. And the reason of not speaking Spanish was, we were alleging, was a pretext to make sure that all of their servers were Hispanic, again, to sort of fit in with the theme. And this is not legal. I mean, for any restaurant or any employer to put in a requirement, like a language requirement, it has to be, and this is the legal phrase of art, job-related and consistent with business necessity. And in most instances, it is not job-related and consistent with business necessity.
Lisser says one reason there haven't been more cases like this is that the EEOC is a charge-driven agency. In other words, a restaurant worker would have to come to them.
We don't go out looking for discrimination. We don't have the resources, or our law doesn't really permit it. People come to us and file charges, and we sort of take those charges and investigate them, and in some instances, we file a lawsuit in federal court on them. And I want to make very clear that whether or not the EEOC has in fact sued anybody, we don't condone hiring solely on the basis of ethnicity. That is illegal. You cannot decide we're a Chinese restaurant, we only want Chinese, or we're a Mexican restaurant, we only want Latinos. And maybe we need to step up our outreach to specific ethnic chambers of commerce, if they exist, or different organizations of restaurant owners, and let them know what is and is not against the law.
Well, Bailey Hicken in Salt Lake City, Utah, thanks for the question about restaurant hiring. As you can see, there are a lot of answers, most of them not fully satisfactory. Personally, I'm kind of torn by what we learned today. If there's a labor market that has customarily organized itself pretty well, maybe with some self-selection, and it seems to be working okay for the firms, the employees, and the customers, well, maybe we should just leave it alone. Who wants more lawyers involved? But on the other hand, if this custom, or whatever it is preventing people who need jobs from getting them based simply on the way they look, well, that's not cool. And it goes against the grain of what a restaurant is supposed to be. A place you can go when you're hungry, maybe tired, and sit down, maybe with your family or a bunch of friends, maybe even alone, and pay some money for the privilege of being served right then and there a nice warm meal. That's why I go to a place like Gabriella's, a nearby place you can walk to where you might run into other people you know. Here to take us home is Nat Milner.
We want to be the place where the neighborhood comes to celebrate. You know, we're not trying to be the greatest restaurant in New York City. You only go to that restaurant on your birthday or anniversary.
Mm-hmm.
We want to be your favorite restaurant. Mm-hmm. We want to be the place you come home, take off your tie, kick off your high heels, come down, grab a margarita and some guacamole and relax.
Cheers. To
Cheers.
Honesty.
To honesty.
Coming up, a Freakonomics Radio listener wants some advice on how to choose the best place to live.
Pretty much everything I like is in suburbs. You know, I like fast food, I like golf courses, I like big houses and big yards and stuff like that. So yeah, pretty much that's what I like.
That's coming up. And for more episodes like this one, check out our podcast archive on iTunes or wherever you listen to podcasts, or at Freakonomics.com, where you'll also find our books, the blog, and much more.
From WNYC Studios, this is Freakonomics Radio. Here's your host, Stephen Dubner.
Every now and again, Steve Levitt and I ask you, our listeners and readers, to send us questions, and then we try to answer them. It is called Frequently Asked Questions. Here's a question from Joe Westhead. The subject line is "The Economics of Choosing a Hometown." He writes, "Hi, chaps." I don't know if anybody's ever called us chaps before. I like that. Do you feel chappy?
He must not be American. Is he American?
Oh, can't tell from any of his identifiers. Let's read the email. All right, so here's a question I've been pondering, he writes. Perhaps you'll find it interesting. I'm one of the growing number of people who can work remotely from a laptop as long as I have internet. I'm free to live in any city I like. Presumably any non-city too. How would an economist go about choosing a place to live, attempting not to be biased by prejudice? How should you quantifiably choose a hometown? Joe, what do you say, Levitt? If you were starting from scratch, you didn't have to be in any particular place, what are the dimensions and the metrics and the yardsticks that you begin to assemble to figure out the kind of place and the actual place you want to live?
So when economists talk about location, they use the word amenities to mean the kinds of things that people are willing to pay for. So access to theater or to nature or to a good bar scene or things like that. And the thing about amenities in cities is that it's a market, right? So that the places that have lots of amenities, like San Francisco and New York City, also tend to be extremely expensive because space is scarce and people will pay to be close to those amenities. So the problem you face when you try to decide where to live is to figure out, how do you find your way to a city or a location that has a lot of the amenities you like, but not a lot of the amenities you don't really care about? So an interesting example is that couples who have no children don't want typically to live in places that spend a lot of money on education, that have very good school systems. And so consequently, there's a lot of self-selection away from fancy suburbs by people who are childless. I mean, maybe also in addition, fancy suburbs don't have a lot of the fun things to do that childless couples are looking for. There's been some interesting research done on homosexual couples and where they tend to live. They tend to be more affluent than the typical person, and they tend to like different sets of amenities and not have as many kids. And it turns out that if you want to figure out where all the nice places in the country are, you just go to the places where the homosexual couples end up, because they tend to be concentrated in the places that everyone else is willing to pay a whole lot of money to go live in. So I think that's what was Joe.
So if you're looking, yeah, Joe, so he should look for where there are a lot of gay couples living.
Well, but not so clear, because a lot of what you're buying in a city is proximity to places to work. So I was actually, like you, I was surprised he used the word city.
So, well, let me ask you this. You live in a city in Chicago. It's probably not the place you would have picked absent the job at the University of Chicago, though, right?
Right. So I wouldn't live in Chicago, probably, if I didn't teach at the University of Chicago. And I wouldn't live in Hyde Park.
You probably wouldn't live in a city even, would you, or would you?
No, I would live in a suburb for sure, because pretty much everything I like is in suburbs. You know, I like fast food. I like golf courses. I like big houses and big yards and stuff like that. So, yeah, pretty much that's
what I like.
You like
making U-turns across six-lane highways. You like Dairy Queens, right?
But, you know, I'm not big into culture.
You're not. You've never been in a museum in your life, have you?
Not very often, no. Not usually willingly. So I'm not really the kind of person who would pay a lot of money to be close to a central city.
So let me ask you this. So to me, one of the great... Look, I live in New York. I never planned to live in New York City, but I do now, and I've lived here a long time, and I've come to love it. To me, one of the unexpected benefits, unexpected to me only because I was naive, of living in a city, especially New York, is propinquity, like the density of people and ideas and stuff. Now, I don't really like being around people that much or being in, you know, around a lot of people, but I like being in a place where you've got that density and propinquity because the spillover effects are massive. So I wonder if you might feel the same, even though you think you don't like cities too.
I think you make a good point, which is that location really matters. And I think about it in terms of academics. So who do I write my papers with?
Right, the people in your
building.
I tend
to write my papers with the people that I go to lunch with.
Yeah.
And I go to lunch with the people whose offices are right by me. And you can see how much distance matters. I mean, even one floor or certainly a building has an enormous impact on who you interact with. And it's interesting that this somehow persists even in a world in which so much occurs virtually, just because it, any social interaction that takes work tends not to happen.
Getting back to Joe's question about, you know, how you pick the place to live, what's, like, if you're going to look for a place to live, what's one thing that you have to have in that place, let's say, or one thing, maybe not that you have to have, but one thing that to you is a really good signpost or arbiter that this is a place that I can live?
You're saying about me personally?
Yeah.
Well, for me right now, it's all about the kids' schools.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I care more about the kids' schools right. than anything else.
Mm-hmm. All right, that's kind of a standard middle class parent answer. No offense. So let's pretend you're a different you. Let's say you have your preferences that you do have as Steve Levitt, but you're not thinking about a family right now. You're just thinking about you. What's the opposite of the canary in the coal mine? I'll tell you what mine is. Here's the thing: I could never live in a place that doesn't have a good diner. Because I feel like even if I don't want to go to the diner, I like what a diner – a diner is like all things to all people, you know? It kind of – it democratizes the whole idea of eating. So you have like in your neighborhood, your Salonika, your Greek diner where you like to get your steak and eggs and bring home your bone for the dog, right? That's the kind of thing that has to exist for me in a place where I want to live. I like the idea that there's a place where people of all different kinds can get together, and if you got to have breakfast at 5 in the afternoon, we understand. If you have to have moussaka for breakfast, we can arrange that. So what about for you?
Wow, you're much more multi-layered
hungry?
Than I am. I think that, I mean, because I think about of all the things I do, the only thing that I really would be nuts about would be if there wasn't a place where I could play golf mm-hmm. easily.
Mm-hmm. So in a nutshell, we're going to say to Joe, you want to move to a place that has a lot of gay couples, enough wealth that you can handle it, golf, and a good diner.
Can Joe just move into your extra spare bedroom?
I don't know. If I had a spare bedroom, you'd put a putting green in. But yeah, we could offer that. So that does it for this edition of Frequently Asked Questions. Thanks for listening. Thanks especially for sending in your questions. Here are some of your questions that we didn't get to, and in some cases, I'm sure you will understand why.
Is central heating a primary cause of obesity?
Why do South Asians dominate the hotel-motel business?
Why do corporate honchos and mafia dress themselves in expensive suits?
Are people who care about the environment more or less likely to use a toilet cover?
Does being able to swim increase your likelihood of dying due to drowning?
Why is it that runners of East African descent tend to dominate distance running, but runners in the U.S. and Jamaica of West African descent tend to dominate sprints?
Do cardboard cutouts of policemen really deter theft? How about traffic violations?
How many sexual predators still have their foreskins?
I'm Stephen Dubner, and that was Freakonomics Radio. Thanks for listening. We will be back next week. If you cannot wait that long, you can find our entire Freakonomics Radio podcast archive at Freakonomics.com or at iTunes, where you can also subscribe.